Merci. Everybody, my name is Louis-Éric Simard with 63 Reasons. First, I'd like to welcome you to DrupalCamp Montreal 2011. We have, I think, record attendance this year. It's going to be an absolutely awesome program. So we have so much good stuff to put in that we have to start on Friday this year, which is fantastic. I'm very enthusiastic about it all. First question before we start. Who here is a developer, primarily? So almost everybody. And who is a site owner or a business owner? Fantastic. So my speech will apply to both, essentially. I will cover both the business aspects about that have to do with internationalization and also the development aspect, that is, what do you need to do, whether you're a developer or a business owner, to actually maximize your return on investment. So this is a talk. I want to make a clear distinction between two notions. Nowadays, when people want to build a website and want to target multiple cultures and multiple languages, they simply presume to a large extent that if they translate the content, it's going to be sufficient. They'll be able to penetrate the market and have a success in that sphere. My email address is there. I'll be at the end as well. If during the talk if you have any questions and we don't have the time to get to it, please email me and I'll quickly get back to you. When you speak to entrepreneurs, especially when you go in the U.S., in Canada we're a bit more open to doing business abroad, but if you go to the U.S., you will hear things that are always very surprising. They say we're doing super well. 20% of our business is international. I think the most enthusiastic statement I've heard is 50% of our business is coming from countries other than the U.S. or Canada. Well, doing well by that metric is just not good enough. If you look at the G20 countries, those that make up for about two-thirds of the world's population and 80% of the world trade, you're looking at 4.6 billion customers. But in the U.S. and Canada, you only have 322 million people. So if you're only doing 50% of your trade abroad, then obviously you're not doing very well. What you have to do is to basically, in theory, do 15 times more revenues outside your territory, outside North America, than you are doing in the country proper. Of course, this presumes two things being equal. First, that you have the same amount of penetration in the country for internet usage and e-commerce. It actually varies. Some countries have better penetration than the U.S. and Canada in terms of internet access, and habits, of course, will vary per country. But at least you should do anywhere between 10 and 15 times your domestic revenues. When I say domestic, I mean North American, for this effort to actually be qualified as good. So people do translation. They think it's the first step, but this is not. It is certainly the most expensive step. This is where you have to hire people who are specialized and will be able to carry a language and your content in multiple languages, but it is not the most critical step. And we're going to talk about this a bit in the future. In Drupal 6, having a site that would be multilingual was sort of a challenge. It was still hackerish. In Drupal 7, we finally have a fantastic system that allows for multiple languages, content to be well translated, and as of yesterday, basically all the small remaining bugs left in Drupal 7 in terms of translation seems to be resolved, which is fantastic. When you do a translation, you basically have an expense, and what you do is the Field of Dreams method of marketing. That is, you build it and you hope that people will come. It doesn't work. If you only do this, it's a really great way to have a very low return on investment. So, a warning first. This talk is not about political correctness. Political correctness is the idea that you have to presume a welcoming environment, that you know people are all the same in some way. But really, what we're looking for here is marketing. When we talk about marketing, we want to exacerbate the differences between people. And you want to see what's rich, what's unique about them, what makes them different from who we are. And in the process, avoid something called that the ethnographers call moral imperialism. That is, if I look at somebody else from a different country through my eyes as North American and evaluate and judge and observe through my eyes, I'm essentially forcing them through a funnel of having them having to conform to what my own view of the world. And this is not a proper way to essentially be able to reach them. I want you to think in this talk not about language, not about countries, but about culture. countries will split existing cultures. One example, for example, will be Morocco and Tunisia. When you go to Morocco and you say, "Hey, I went to Tunisia," Moroccans will say, "Hey, it's the same country. It's the same behavior," and vice versa. So, having a culture, the Maghreb culture, is one sort of entity we can think about. If you go into Canada, for example, then you have clearly two very distinct cultures. Some would say three, and essentially you have cultures that do not match country boundaries. So the world is not as we think it is. Success abroad and success at home are not the same. If you look at, for example, Google is not the dominant search engines in many markets. Who knows who that might be? In some markets, Baidu is very popular in the South Asian markets. The overall search engine that is the most successful in G20 outside of North America and a few countries in Europe is still Yahoo. Because Yahoo does something absolutely amazing. They adapt every single one of their websites to the country in which people will search. While Google tries to make a really simple, very uniform approach where they put the logo, it's the same links, it's a uniform kind of offering. But even then, if you look at country-specific search engines, many search engines are actually beating both Yahoo and Google. So I want to show you an example of that. If you go to Russia, the main search engine is not Yahoo, it's not Google. It's called Yandex. And it doesn't look anything like Yahoo. It doesn't look like Google. There's no white page. It's still a very efficient kind of layout. It has very prominent advertising right in the middle of the screen that's almost obtrusive. This is not how we would design a website for North America. And I'll show you a bit later in the talk how to think in such a way that you can decipher these things, actually build something that actually matches individual countries. I'll show you a few modules by which you can do these things as well. The other thing is, when you look at the different countries, social networks will vary a lot. If you go to Japan, the dominant social network is called Mixi. Facebook is not even showing up in the top three. If you go in Russia, you have a bit of something that's going to do a bit of a mind trick on you, because you'll think you've seen this site somewhere before. VKontakte. It may look a bit like a copy of Facebook, all right? It is beating Facebook incredibly well. The same thing, Odnoklassniki is beating Classmates. It was an older Web 1.0 environment. So when you go in those countries, do not presume that because a brand is doing well here, that if you emulate them abroad, you will have very good results. Often, you will not. So, ingredient number one. First thing you want to do when you build a website that's culturally friendly, that welcomes people, that makes sure that people will be your customers, is you want to make sure that they feel welcome. There's nothing worse, for example, if you go to your own birthday and there's a reception for you and there's a birthday cake and there's the wrong name on the cake, right? It doesn't feel like it is your birthday. It feels like somebody else's and you're stepping on somebody else's toes. But the same thing happens here when we build websites. I'll give you a great example here. In this case, New Scientist. When I want to register on New Scientist, let's say I'm going here to subscribe. It will tell me I'm in Canada, which is great, from the McGill campus. It has a database of universities only. So when I log in from home on Videotron, it's going to go and it's going to default to the very first country on the list. And what is the first country in the list of all countries? Afghanistan. So as I'm trying to log in, it presumes, you might be in Afghanistan. Which, if you look at the roads here, it may look a bit the same, but we're not. So that's a bit of a snafu that they have there. And one thing that's also very funny is that if you subscribe to the newsletter, to an article, or to the website, the detection of country will be always different. It's like they implemented it three different ways on two different times. What we want to do is we want to have one simple interface. So what I do suggest is that under Drupal 7, we'll talk about only Drupal 7 modules in this talk, use the Smart IP module. It is right now the very best GeoIP system that you can have. It does, you know, there are a few pitfalls, I'll talk about those, but essentially it'll tell you from where your visitor is in general. Only use the country, even though Smart IP will give you province or state and city. Try to ignore that. There are so many exceptions that this is seldom good data unless you pay for it. In terms of pitfalls, be careful on very small countries and on border areas. You know, it is very common for people, for example, to buy their cell phones, cell phone providers from a different country and deliver right on the border if they have a better deal on the other side. If you have very small countries like Monaco, Liechtenstein, or Lesotho, you end up with extremely small countries, so likely you'll catch the waves of the neighboring countries, and you will not have a really clear delineation of where your customer is from. But for the rest of the talk, we'll mostly talk about G20 countries, so these countries are not really a concern. Ingredient number two, make people feel at home. So there is the illusion that Americanization will change the web, that as we progress, all websites will look the same, and you know, foreign people are basically like us, except they speak this weird different language. And this is a completely wrong way of seeing it. It is comforting in a way, because when we see some successes on the market, like VContact that I showed you before, it looks like a copy of Facebook. When you look at a bunch of Groupon clones around the world, they look like Groupon. They actually copied some of the graphics directly. But this is only, they're only dominant right now as brands that are local because they moved first. They actually started promoting before the brands they're copying went into those markets. In reality, as time goes on, the very local brands actually rise to the top and usually eclipse these copycat sites. When we look, for example, at Google, as I said before, if you go on google.ru, you would not be mistaken if it looks a lot like google.com, google.jp, or google.ca. Basically, it is the same page. Often the doodle, even if it's not culturally relevant, is reused again and again. Whereas if you look at Yahoo, what they do is fantastic. If you look at Yahoo Japan, you have a set of icons that are very, you know, very friendly, fun, it's animated. The color scheme is actually going towards the red colors, which we'll see in Japan and Korea are basically colors that, you know, symbolize life and good luck. And the layout is somewhat unique to Japan. It's been customized. So if I compare this to Yahoo.com, you see that, or in this case Canada, because it was default there, the layout is very different. We have a very clean, spacey layout that is not as busy as a Japanese website does. So Yahoo in Japan is actually beating Google, and for a reason, and for a very small investment in terms of time. If you look at UAE websites, this is interesting. When you want to make people feel at home, you also have to respect their cultures, whether you agree with it or not. So if I go on most UAE websites, what I'll find is that there are very few pictures of people. Within the Islamic environments, it's extremely unfriendly to use human-looking graphics in either logos or images or, you know, in general imagery. And what you will find is most often what you see is pictures of men. So I'm going to look at the four random sites. Very few people, always guys. And when you have women, they are covered or extremely well hidden. So as you go into these markets, you really have to honor the way in which they do business and not try to impose how we see the world upon them. So this means that you have to essentially build a design for every basically every culture. So how do you do this? Well, first, don't try to design these things at home. No matter how much you think you've hacked into the culture of somebody else, you will not be able to find the small steps that actually make it feel local. Hire local designers. What is very nice about this is that in many of these countries, the competition is not the same, so you end up with designers who are actually less expensive than here. And as you build your site, if you have only one site, and we'll talk about multi-sites a bit later, but if you have only one site, you want to be able to show the layout immediately based on, you know, where your visitor is coming from. So one great module in Drupal 7 is called Theme Key. It works with Smart IP to essentially show a theme that matches country that the person is visiting from. Try not to save the country of origin and make theming decisions based on sign-ups. Where people sign up is not necessarily where they'll be or where they actually are in general. So don't use this, the IP address and location of their first sign-up or their first visit as an indicator of what they want, especially if you go in Northern Africa where people travel a lot for trade. If they do sign up in Yemen, it doesn't mean that they are actually Yemeni. They might be UAE resident, Emirati, or Egyptians. Brand it well. Now, this is an interesting part of the talk because we've all heard of these fantastic mistakes that brands have made in the past. I'll go on a few of them. The dominant baby food brand, you know, in the world is called Gerber. Now, if you go in France, Gerber means gerber in French, which means to violently vomit. Which, as you look at the baby food that they serve, perhaps it would be inspirational. Colgate, again in France, decided to sell this wonderful brand of Colgate Q. Right? So it may not be your favorite taste in the morning, but what does this mean in French? It means ass, but in the most pornographic way, you know? So I'm not judging if this is your favorite flavor, that's good, but, you know. And as you'll see, most of these mistakes systematically, are either highly scatological or sexual. I don't know why, but it's really funny. Freud would be super happy with that. Coca-Cola had this branding problem when it came into China because as they would sell their products, the local merchants did not know how to write this. So they would use local Chinese characters to try to imitate the sound of Coca-Cola, which actually meant in Chinese, bite the wax tadpole. Not very appetizing. The Mitsubishi Pajero is a four-wheel drive, reasonably successful in Australia. Unless when you go to Spain, it means you're a masturbator. Same way, the Ford Pinto. Pinto in Portugal means that you have small male genitals. I love this one especially. This is in Sweden. The company is called Locum. L-O-C-U-M, right? Panasonic wanted to make very friendly television sets, and they licensed Woody the Woodpecker. Let me find the exact statement that he used. All right. As you started the TV in the browser based building a TV, the Japanese version had been translated locally to touch Woody the Internet Pecker. You sort of want to avoid these things when you build brands. IKEA makes mistakes again and again and again, some think on purpose. One of the most amazing, or at least to me, was when they launched the Fartful desk, which they followed by the Jerker desk. Then they went to Korea and translated an ad in a billboard and had locals translate to English again, so English to Korean to English, to appeal to the expats. And it made one mistake that is so glamorous, so wonderful, so funny, they actually use it nowadays as a campaign. So they want to sell their extras that were on the floor, the demo units. So they invited people to come and see their chairs and desks. The English version was, come and take a look at our stool samples. It is now used as a billboard in Los Angeles. Another example is Clairol Mist Stick or the Rolls-Royce Silver Mist. Mist in Germany means shit. Umbro Zyklon. They want to make a bunch of sneakers. Beautiful name. Zyklon looks very futuristic. It's also a name, the gas that the Nazis used to kill the Jews. This is not necessarily a good way to market your product. Onda Fitta. Fitta means pussy in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. Sharwood Bundt sauces. So if you presume that it's okay to export UK food, Sharwoods has decided to go into, you know, markets that were a part of Commonwealth. So until they reached Punjab, where Bund also means ass. Traficante mineral water from Italy also means in Spain basically a drug lord. Wang as a company, whatever they do is wrong, but one specific example is when Wang wanted to have a tech support environment in the UK, they proposed the following tagline, Wang cares. Now, my British accent is not so great, but if you say it fast, it says, Wang cares. The Kansai Nippon Tourist Company, I love this one, this is really funny. Kansai is a province of Japan that has two different names. Kansai being the official one, and the local friendly one being Kinki. So the Kinki Nippon Tourist Company started receiving calls from tourists asking about sex tours of Japan. So we all hear these things, but don't be paranoid. Like, they're funny. They actually can be good for marketing if you use it well. If you think about it, a site like Experts Exchange, not Experts Sex Change, is still in business and doing well, so you don't have to worry too much about it. A better approach, though, is to rebrand. There is this book that I recommend everybody reads called Positioning. It's a really old marketing book, about 25 years ago, from Al Ries and Jack Trout. That basically goes into the process, you know, how the mind reacts to a brand based on its cultural significance. Do read this book, and you'll recognize that the first thing you want to do is in every country, not extend the brand that you have in the U.S. and Canada and reuse it in different countries, but actually build a strong local brand that holds its own in the market. So another way to make sure that you have good designs, that you can build these things on the cheap, it used to be very expensive to build a brand locally, but nowadays we have 99 designs, we have contractors on Odesk, Rent-A-Coder, and places like that, and you have Mechanical Turk. Mechanical Turk, anybody knows about it before? One, two. Basically, it's a site where you give people a small job and you pay them very little money to fulfill that job. So you can say, let's say you want to send a bunch of logos and see how culturally significant they are to people, let's say, in Germany. Then basically you would put the different logos and assign homework to people who come from Japan and offer them maybe a dollar to give their opinion about that logo. And you can, over time, have a good enough sample that you know if this is a good logo for that local environment. You don't have to guess. You don't have to hire experts. For a few hundred to a few thousand bucks per country, you'll be done. In certain markets, the Mechanical Turk expectation is a 1 or 2 cents per question. So on some third world market, then essentially you can have your old market research done for about 10 bucks, which is pretty amazing. In terms of a technical solution, obviously you don't, you know, if you have multiple sites that are individually branded, you also will have shared content, and you want that. You don't want to spend money rebuilding completely new sites. So what you do is you use basically Drupal 7s or Drupal 6s multi-site feature and use this fantastic module called Domain Access, which allows you to say, all these nodes that we have, we can reuse on these, this one, and that domain as well. So essentially, you end up with shared content. If you already have translated material on your website, then you only have one major investment in terms of content production, which is exactly what you want so you can save some money. Number 4, translate wisely. Now, this is an area in which companies usually... large multinational companies have learned the hard way to not be cheap on translation. So the Parker Pen Company advertised this wonderful pen. They wanted to say, you know, if you put it in your pocket, it's not going to leak. The translation was, if you put it on your pocket, you will not become pregnant. KFC wanted to translate their slogan, finger licking good, to Chinese. So they sent the order to a Chinese translator, who basically did the job, and nobody verified it. So finger licking good translated to essentially eat your own fingers. Salem cigarettes in Japan wanted to say, you know, you want Salem feeling free was their slogan. It was turned into, when smoking Salem, you can feel so refreshed that your mind seems to be free and empty. Schweppes, tonic water, was translated as Schweppes toilet water. Sales were not that great. So what you do is, the solution there is not to cheap out, Right? Translation nowadays is extremely inexpensive. You'll pay a few cents per word, whereas previously you'd pay a dollar or two per word, sometimes a lot more for translation. The market is far more competitive than it's ever been in the past. So what you want to do is you want to use something called back translation. So back translation is you hire a completely different translator, one that doesn't know the first. They're not buddies, they're not friends, they're not family, they don't work together. And ask them to translate back what the first person translated to the target language back to your language. If it still makes sense, you have a good shot of not having made a major mistake. Obviously, you don't want to do this on over all of your content. Maybe you'll take a sample, like 10%. That should be sufficient in general to see if your translator is actually doing a good job. If you're very paranoid, if you have like a very high-value brand like Burke's or McDonald's, then definitely retranslate everything using back translation. Number five, what's your symbols? Do not presume that because you use symbols and they're common to your friends and to your family, that the rest of the world uses them the very same way. So I spoke before about graphic design in Islamic countries. It is a huge societal taboo to actually use facial or human forms in those designs. You must absolutely avoid them. So if you have the logo, for example, of KFC of the Colonel, this is not the logo you can use in most of these countries. In Korea, having red is a color of good luck. If you go to Korean houses, you'll often find door frames painted in red to wish good luck and good fortune upon the person who walks underneath. So knowing these things is a fantastic competitive advantage when you build a brand. Obviously, you want to use local contractors. But there's a twist to it, I'll get to it a bit in the future. Consider the fact that many countries have very diverse expectations about what it means to belong to that country. Some of us would take maybe the moral position that it is very racist for a country to only show people of a certain ethnic origin, but that's still what's happening in very many countries. Now, you may believe it is wrong, but the customer over there is basically the person who feels that things are right. And this is basically a notion that is taught in business schools wrongly as ethics. Ethics being somehow thought as, you know, what we think is right, we should bring elsewhere. But in reality, if you look at the word ethics in philosophy, it's ETH, the relationship of self to one's environment. So how people behave there is very ethical, so long as it fits their own environment. Do not go and challenge the rules unless this is your political objective for the future. A very interesting example of this was Italy. Italy has, like all of us, this fantastic symbol that says, this is good, right? This is a good symbol. They also wanted to show that their tomatoes were of an excellent quality. So they printed a poster, which they sent all across Europe, especially to Portugal, where this means go yourself, and tomatoes means testicles. The slogan was, our testicles are bigger than yours. The embassy complained, and there was quite a row surrounding this. When you hire people, you have to empower them, and this is a very tricky situation, because when people have a job with you, and you're a high-paying North American hirer of contractors, you will have a tendency in many countries and many cultures not to have people who will challenge what it is that you ask them to do. But you must empower them to tell you that if you're doing something wrong, they should be able to tell you. They should be rewarded for telling you. So you have to open up the field and make this extremely easy to do. In many countries, for example, it is absolutely unacceptable in certain parts of India, for example, to actually challenge your boss, to actually tell him he has a bad idea. But what you want is somebody you can trust to tell you you're doing something wrong, and you want that. So make sure that when you hire contractors, Odesk, Rent-A-Coder, everywhere, that you tell them that. It'll be a cultural shock for many of them, but it's going to be good value for you. Another warning. They say that all politics is local. It is very true in many countries. I'm going to take one example because I've been there a few years ago, and I was always amazed by what they did, is in Tanzania. Now, this is not a G20 country, but this problem, this thing I'm going to discuss, is also true in many other nations. Tanzania is the merger of two countries, Tanganyika, which is the land part in East Africa, and this beautiful island called Zanzibar. And Tanganyika is the conjunction of a few dozen tribes who got together under German rule at that time and decided to actually develop a common language, Kiswahili, and common laws and common government. They were not very powerful as a country, so they merged with the neighboring Muslim country of Zanzibar to form Tanzania. The average view then as a marketer would be, oh, then you have a challenge because you have a Muslim side where you have graphical expectations and ways in which we represent imagery that will be very different from the actually Roman Catholic side of Tanganyika. So what do you do? Well, in this case, most people there do not want to be differentiated. They actually value the fact that they have a unity in a country that would normally be extremely divided because they make this daily constant effort to have only one communal sense of belonging to a very multicultural environment. So you'll have a very similar situation when you go to Belgium, for example, where you have two highly divisive languages, Flemish and French, being spoken there. Do not take sides. If you have to guess a language, offer both. Do not offer only one of them. If you go to Tanzania, if you have Kiswahili and you have if you have Arabic, then offer both. Do not make a guess. Do not try to make a guess if this visitor is from the island or from the mainland. You'll spend a lot of money for nothing, and often you'll be wrong at your very own expense. Now, one question is, like we talked, and this is where people usually get a bit scared, where there's so much more work to do, right? I have all these websites. How come I have to rebuild my website for every single market? We've already covered the fact that your main expense is basically in translation. If you are going to other countries, other cultures, you've already, in theory, made that expense. And the rest of it is very small design tweaks, and designers abroad tend to be very inexpensive due to limited competition. But you want to make sure you have at least 20 countries for a G20. You want to know exactly where you're going to put your efforts, where it makes sense to go first. There are three methods. All of them presume a constant K. But a K is very simple. You take the discretionary income per capita on average. Discretionary income is whatever is left in your pocket. In North America, it's mostly minus something. For private expenses, once you've taken off your basic life expenses, that is apartment, food, and transportation. Whatever is left, you can target towards, you know, home purchases, embellishment, leisure activities, non-essential product services. So you want to use only that number, and it's always available on the net. There's so much research on that because it is so valuable as a piece of information, but only for the strata of the country that actually has a common access to the internet. So you want to multiply the average income by the average internet penetration of the country. If it's 60%, you take 60%. Now, if you have an e-commerce website, use the fraud rate data. PayPal will offer it. Your payment provider will offer it as well. And discount by multiplying that K by 1 minus that fraud rate. Because you don't want to make an investment in a country, for example, like Nigeria, where your fraud rate will approach 50%. You should discount the value of every single effort you do there by 50%. So I'm going to use this formula. The slide will be, of course, on the website, so always have access to it, to discuss the three methods in which you can actually make a decision about where to go. The first one is the reactive method. Reactive method is you use a module like visitors, fantastic little module, that will tell you where your visitors are coming from right now. And you'll notice two patterns. You have the pattern of people who are coming, let's say, from Japan, and are coming to your Canadian website. And you're thinking, wow, I have 3% of my traffic coming from Japan. You'll notice a second pattern, the one visit bounce rate. People who simply come to your website once, they're so confused that they don't feel they are recognized. They have no idea what the content is because it's not translated, for example, that they bounce and go away. Often that's because your website had very salient, very important keywords in it that actually drew this traffic to your own website. So you have something there. It's just not exploited. So the lowest, the cheapest way to figure out where to go is to basically go in visitors, ask for a view by country of the number of visitors who did a quick bounce or who come to visit regularly, and multiply that total score by K, rank these countries. The one that's on top is where you want to put your money first. That's if you take a reactive approach. That is usually a good method for very small companies, very small websites, or people with extremely tight budgets. A slightly better approach, a proactive method. So instead of looking at what you already got and try to foster it, you actually look at where it is that you want to go. So what you do is basically multiply K by, if you have a website with, you know, specific keywords that are important to you, do a Google search, limited by country, see how many pages rank in that country or in that language for the keyword that you want, and divide that by the number of rankable pages that you have on your own website. So if you have 10,000 nodes, you only have 8,000 that rank in Google, then use 8,000 as a divider. That's going to give you a score per country. Again, you want to invest your money in the top-ranked country first. This is where you're going to make the most amount of money. I see a few confused eyes there. Are we okay with the math? No questions? Okay, all right. We'll have a pretty decent question period at the end, so you guys will be able to ask any questions you want. The only pitfall about this method is that it presumes that 100% of your visibility is driven by organic search. This is not necessarily true. Your competitors may be able to buy search traffic, or they may be able to advertise locally in the country, and you will not be able to quantify it as part of this formula. So it's a good general approach. If you have bigger budgets and you can afford to be more than reactive, you can say, well, I don't have any traffic coming from Germany, but I really want to develop into Germany. This is how you make that decision of go or no go. The third method is the strategic method. This is mostly for larger companies because it's very expensive to do. It is to do market-driven analysis. So you have people who will look at every single variable in every single country to see what is your chance, you know, of having a good return on investment. Usually when you can hire these people, when they work for you, you have at least 100 employees on average, and you have the budgets to actually make trial attempts. The first two methods basically give you rather instant results. You know, things rank pretty quickly on Google, and you get a very quick reward for your efforts. This method, you know, presumes that you have the ability to go for the long run and make a few mistakes. Now, on this, there is one different technical solution to use. So you still use visitors to verify, you know, that your effort is actually right. If you say, I'm going to target Germany, are you seeing a spike in German visitors on your website, yes or no? If you're not, you're doing something wrong. If you are, then you know, it confirms that you're making the right decision. But do not only use your own data. If you're going to be a large enterprise, then also subscribe to third-party analytics services that will confirm your data. Because you do not want, for example, a server bias or a corrupt database to lead you to believe that you're actually making headways when you are not. That's it. So we talked about, you know, what you need to do to be able to go in a different country, how do you make decisions about that, what to be careful about, and how to do it on the cheap using very quickly available Drupal resources. So that's the talk. If you have any questions, I'd welcome them. Right. Let me go back to it. Okay. So we were on this one here. Okay. Right. So, the question, yeah, so how do you evaluate the possibility? So you take the score K, the individual basically reachable value within a customer, okay? So this we already calculated. And you want to see what is the likelihood. Basically, this divider at the end will show you, you know, what are your chances of actually reaching that customer. So if you have, let's say, a very unique keyword, and on the internet there's only two pages that belong to your competitor, and you have only one page with that unique keyword that belongs to you. Well, if your competitor is already on that market, you know, he has two chances, and if you come in with your page, you have one chance, right? So essentially, actually, the both numbers should be introverted. Essentially, you want to calculate what is the fraction of rankable pages that you will be able to reach your target customer base with. Go ahead. First, because it works really well with Smart IP, which is a really good thing. It's going to change as time moves because we have a ton of D6 modules that are fantastic that haven't been ported yet that use, for example, the GeoIP module. So we're going to see these things coming up. Visitors is the most mature solution at the moment. It has great value. Obviously, we're going to see something better coming up as well. You can have segmented by time of visits. So you can go pretty deep, you know. Same thing you would buy from a third-party service, essentially, you'll get for free on Google Analytics. But, you know, if you buy the premium packages, you're going to find that, essentially. The only thing, though, is that, you know, it's still based. It's like the judge, you know, being the crook at the same time. You basically have a piece of data that tells you, oh, my customer is coming from, let's say, Italy. And then you have your analytics package to say, oh, where's this customer coming from? Oh, Italy. Well, of course, you know, because it uses the same data. There is no impartiality. So whenever you can, do use something else on top of that to validate your data. But basically, it's a good start. And it's actually more, you can play with it. You have a good database of information. And you can, you know, extract better reports than what you can find in a SaaS package on the web. Questions? All right. No, that's usually a much more complex topic than that. You guys are shy. All right. Well, thank you very much. Next presentation that we have there, does somebody have their program handy? Oh, we have Matt here who's going to give a talk about how to import data with Migrate. That's an interesting topic. I hope you guys stay for it. In technical terms, I think it's going to be kind of challenging. So that's it. So you have some time to discuss. Thank you. Oh, as giveaway prizes at the end of the weekend, 60 Reasons will give coupons for free translation and internationalization work to people who are present in the room. So it's going to be offered. Thank you.